On this July 1st, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your Thursday headlines. The search and rescue effort has been paused at the site of the condo collapse in Surfside, Florida, over concerns that the other half of the building could potentially collapse. The president and first lady traveling to South Florida today, visiting with first responders and the families of the victims. Speaker Nancy Pelosi today naming Republican Representative Liz Cheney to the House Select Committee that will investigate what happened on January 6th inside and outside the U.S. Capitol. After a two-year investigation, prosecutors in New York unsealing an indictment against the Trump Organization and a top company executive. And the CDC is warning that COVID cases have risen 10% nationwide in the last week and that the hypertransmissible Delta variant now accounts for 1 in 4 of those new cases. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin in Surfside, Florida, just outside of Miami. Earlier today, the rescue efforts were halted because of concerns about the instability of a condo section still standing. It comes 1 week after the South Building literally collapsed. Rescuers stopping work at the site shortly after 2 o'clock this afternoon. That's because on-site engineers had identified that one column had shifted between 8 to 10 inches, and there were 3 new cracks that were expanding. It has been an emotional roller coaster for the families as they wait for any news of their loved ones. And now Tropical Storm Elsa forming in the Caribbean, which may further delay the search. The president and first lady meeting with family members as well as local and state officials. He delivered these remarks.
The governors and the mayor have been completely open with me, asked whatever they've asked, but I think we've been able to deliver. And I think there's more that we can do, including I think I have the power, and we'll know shortly, that to be able to pick up 100% of the costs for the county and the state over the first 30 days. I think I'm quite sure I can do that. And so we're going to do that. And there's going to be a lot, you all know it, because a lot of you have been through it as well. There's going to be a lot of pain and anxiety and suffering and even the need for psychological help in the days and months that follow. And so we're not going anywhere.
Thank you, Mr. President.
For real. But again, I just wanted to, start today if I could, but getting as thorough a briefing as you're able to give me. Tell me what you need. And that goes for both the senators and the congresswoman and anyone in Florida just to pick up the phones and overall, for real. I'm not joking about it. I think the governor will tell you anything you ask for. We got. We have another group of teams coming from FEMA today. How many people will it be?
By the end of the day, there should be about 500 on the ground.
500 on the ground. So, again, this is your show.
That with President Joe Biden in an editorial this morning, the Miami Herald writing the following quote. Mr. President, you will see that our hearts are broken for those personally devastated by the horrific collapse of the Champlain Tower South a week ago. More than 140 people remain unaccounted for after the early morning collapse swallowed more than 35 oceanfront condo units and the people who lived in them. We wholeheartedly support the wider probe by this agency that investigated the World Trade Center collapse. But what happened to this 12-story building is a warning for the rest of Florida and for the country, especially coastal communities lined with similar oceanfront buildings, many over 40 years old, and revealing the wear and tear of time, seaside corrosion, and intrusive flooding. The editorial found online at MiamiHerald.com. And by the way, the bodies found today, 2 children, ages 10 and 4, their parents among the confirmed dead. A makeshift memorial has been set up near the condo site in Surfside, Florida. More with the president in Florida, joined by Governor Ron DeSantis.
Well, thank you, Mr. President, and you recognize the severity of this tragedy from day one, and you've been very supportive. We in Florida, you'll drive up and down these coastal roads, you'll see these buildings, and I've driven by that building, probably never thought twice, and then something like this happens, and you recognize in each individual unit, there's an amazing story, and lives have been shattered irrevocably as a result of this. We've already identified, unfortunately, fatalities, people who've been 92 years old, have been the matriarch of a wonderful family. We have families with kids missing, and we even have young newlyweds who hadn't even been married a year who were in the tower when it collapsed. And so the cooperation has been great. The local, both the municipal and the county, have been fantastic. And you guys have not only been supported at the federal level, but we've had no bureaucracy. When we're dealing with FEMA, we're literally getting requests routed from local to state to federal in no time, and the approval's happening. Yeah, and so that really, I think is important. And so we've had people. This is the first response in Florida's history outside of a hurricane where all of our urban search and rescue teams were mobilized. So they've been going in and out of the rubble, searching, trying to find people, trying to rescue people. At a minimum, trying to identify anyone who may be deceased to bring closure to the families, which is very important. But they're tired, and this has taken a toll on them. And so the fact that we now have that search and rescue team from Virginia here, and I know we have some more on the way, that's going to be helpful because this is grueling. And obviously the families' lives have been shattered. Mental health is going to be important. We're going to need some mental health support for some of the folks who've been in that rubble because it's not easy to do. But we thank for the support, and we do appreciate the collaboration for local, state, and federal. And, you know, what we just need now is we need a little bit of luck, need a little bit of prayers, and, you know, we would like to be able to, you know, to see some miracles happen. But I can tell you this, we're not going to stop, you know, until we identify everybody and until we do what we need to do. So thank you, Mr. President.
From Florida early today with Governor Ron DeSantis and the president, joined by First Lady Jill Biden. And among the stops, a makeshift memorial near the site of that collapsed condo where there are flowers and pictures of loved ones and the president and the First Lady paying their respects, looking at the notes and the faces of those who succumbed in that condo collapse. And news from the Supreme Court, which today upheld two Arizona election laws in a 6-3 decision, with the three Democratic-appointed justices dissenting. The court saying that Arizona did not violate the Voting Rights Act with a 2016 law that allows only voters, their family members, or their caregivers to deliver a completed ballot. In the majority opinion written by Justice Samuel Alito, appointed by President George W. Bush, saying the law requires, quote, equal openness to the voting process. Mere inconvenience cannot be enough to demonstrate a violation of the law. Justice Elena Kagan in the dissent saying that the ruling undermines the Voting Rights Act, which she said referred to as a statute that stands as a monument to America's greatness. Also today, the Supreme Court upheld a state policy that requires election officials to throw out ballots accidentally cast in the wrong precincts. And now to Capitol Hill, one day after House Democrats, joined by two Republicans, voting to create a select committee looking into the events of January 6th. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi named members of that committee, and among her selections, Republican Representative Liz Cheney. She, of course, was ousted earlier this year from her leadership post by House Republican lawmakers. Speaker Pelosi has the authority to appoint the 13 members of the committee, with five of those picks made in consultation with Republican leader Kevin McCarthy. We'll hear from him in just a moment. In addition to Congresswoman Cheney, Pelosi's other picks including the following: Democratic Representatives Benny Thompson, Elaine Luria, Jamie Raskin, Stephanie Murphy, Pete Aguilar, Adam Schiff, and Zoe Lofgren. Now, Representative Thompson is also the top Democrat on the House Homeland Security Committee. He will serve as the chair of this new select committee. More from today's news conference and announcement with Speaker Pelosi.
It's really important for you all to know what our purpose is for this. And that is that the findings of the legislation speak to the testimony of the director of the FBI when he basically said there were more deaths from domestic terrorism than from global terrorism in our country in the previous year. Testimony from the Department of Homeland Security about concerns that are out there. All of these institutions talking about, well, I hate to even go there, but it's what they have said in terms of white supremacy, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, all of these attitudes that have contributed to what happened on January 6th. And so that is our purpose. You can go to speaker.gov to read the findings which establish the purpose of what we are setting out to do, to make sure that this never happens again. I just put out a press release so you have the names of the members on the committee. Again, it was our hope that we could have done this with a bipartisan outside commission. Maybe one day that will be possible. It took 14 and a half months for the 9/11 commission to be signed into law. Perhaps this is on the horizon. But in the meantime then, and in the meantime now, it was going to be a congressional investigation. Then I happened to be a co-chair of that investigation. It was bipartisan and bicameral. As you can see, it might be hard to do bicameral since they limit the investigation on their side as to what we can look into. But I'm very proud. And as I say, decisions are liberating. They enable you to go to the next step. And the next step for us has always been to seek and to find the truth.
And we'll get some background on Speaker Pelosi's announcement in just a moment. Mike Lillis of The Hill newspaper and TheHill.com. Five people died during the January 6th insurrection, including Capitol Hill police officer Brian Sicknick, who died just hours after engaging with rioters, a medical examiner saying he died of natural causes. Two Capitol police officers died by suicide, and more than 100 officers, both Capitol and Metropolitan Police, were injured. New video released by the Justice Department depicting what was clearly a chaotic scene at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, particularly against police officers. New sound of what it was like the afternoon of January 6th. That was the scene outside the U.S. Capitol the afternoon of January 6th. New video released by the Justice Department. It's available on YouTube. What remains unclear this evening is who Leader McCarthy might name to the committee, if anyone. The Republican leader warning freshman GOP lawmakers not to accept an appointment to the Select Committee from Speaker Pelosi unless they were willing to lose their other committee assignments. The California Republican speaking briefly to reporters earlier today.
Why should Liz Cheney lose her committee assignments for agreeing to serve on a select committee to investigate what happened on January 6th?
I'm not making any threats about committee assignments, but as you know how Congress works, you get elected by your district, and you get your committees from your conference. So when Jeff Van Drew left the party and became a Republican, he got lost his committee assignments from the Speaker and got them from the Republican Conference. When Justin Amash left, he then went and got his committee assignments from the Speaker. I don't know in history where someone would go get their committee assignments from the Speaker and expect them to have them from the conference as well.
You haven't even criticized some of your own members, like Andrew Clyde, who said that it was a normal tourist visit that day, yet she can lose her committee assignments for wanting to investigate what happened.
Why would you criticize Let me be very clear. I'm not threatening anybody with committee assignments. What I'm saying is it was shocking to me that if a person is a Republican, they get their committee assignments from the Republican Conference. For somebody to accept committee assignments from Speaker Pelosi, that's unprecedented. Yes.
Do you regret not supporting the bipartisan commission idea now that you're going to have to deal with a committee that you have even less control over and an opportunity to influence and arguably would be more political?
No. I regret the politics of Nancy Pelosi.
With more in today's developments with this select committee, we're joined on the phone with Mike Lillis. He is covering the story for The Hill newspaper and TheHill.com. Let's begin with Republican leader Kevin McCarthy in terms of his options putting members on this committee. What are they?
Well, he has two options. One, he can follow the letter of the law, and he can make these recommendations. There's 13 members on the committee, and Pelosi has named 8, and he's got 5 recommendations that he can make. So he can pick his 5 and send them over to Pelosi, or he can do nothing. Those are kind of his two options: appoint 5 members, or do nothing at all, and then it truly would be a Pelosi committee, a partisan committee. He came up to the mics today and of course was asked that question and did not answer it. He said, still deciding, and when I have an announcement to make, you'll know about it. But it is a question about whether or not he wants to participate. And if you'll remember back to the Benghazi committee back in 2014, this was the same question that Pelosi faced, because the Democrats, as the Republicans now, were screaming that the Benghazi Select Committee was just uber partisan and wasn't intended to investigate anything. It was just intended to go after Hillary Clinton, just like the Republicans are saying this Select Committee is just intended to go after Donald Trump. And Pelosi had to weigh whether or not she wanted to participate. And in the end, she landed on the decision that, yes, of course we want to participate. We don't want this to be totally one-sided. And so she appointed her members to the Benghazi committee and put Elijah Cummings, the late Elijah Cummings, as the foil to Trey Gowdy, and made some pretty good TV, because those two are pretty feisty and very smart and articulate, and it was a good show all around. But so the best guess is that McCarthy is not going to allow this just to be a one-sided investigation, and then he'll want somebody up there defending the Republican position and defending President Trump and his role in January 6th. We just don't know who they will be, and we don't know when that announcement will come.
But does the Speaker have any veto power over any names that Leader McCarthy would put forward?
Yes, that's kind of the wild card in all of this. If you read the language of the resolution, which passed just yesterday, it says the Speaker shall appoint all 13 members, but five of them will be in consultation with the minority leader, who is Kevin McCarthy. So Pelosi can veto any member that she wants, and we've been asking about that, and we're not quite sure what that means. Does that mean she's not going to allow anybody who voted against the certification of Biden's victory to sit on the panel? Does that mean what does that mean? What is her criteria? What is her gauge? And she has given no indication how she might play that out. And you know, it's also a question for McCarthy. Does he want to put some of the more controversial figures who have really gone out of their way to downplay what happened on January 6th, or does he want to put, just some staunch conservatives who don't agree that this committee is necessary, because the sitting committees are already investigating in the Senate and the House, and of course the FBI is doing its investigations of those who have been arrested. So there's a lot of moving parts, and there's a lot of investigations happening. And one of the central criticisms from the Republicans is that this is simply unnecessary. It's a sideshow. And if McCarthy just wanted to pick some kind of middle of the road guys who were critical of Trump's actions that day, but also opposed this on this Select Committee on those grounds, he could do that, and it would be. And Pelosi would be sure to appoint those people. It wouldn't be controversial. But again, those are all questions for first for McCarthy and then for Nancy Pelosi. And we should have the answer shortly. I don't think this is going to drag out very long, because just after Pelosi announced her eight members today, the chairman of this select committee, Benny Thompson, came out and said, we're already charging ahead. If they don't want to appoint anybody, that's fine. But we're going to have our first hearing with members of the U.S. Capitol Police, who were here that day and want to share their experiences. And if no Republicans are here, we're not going to wait for them. So McCarthy's going to have to do something fairly quickly.
And when will that hearing take place?
Thompson did not say. He didn't say when, and he didn't say who would participate, which officers would be involved. As some of these officers have been much more public and much more active, both from the D.C. Metro Police and from the U.S. Capitol Police. Some have really been making the rounds and have been pushing for the independent commission, for example. But we don't know the details of that. And, of course, the House recessed today and won't be in Washington for two and a half weeks. So would they come back and have a select committee while everybody else was out? I don't think so. I think people are going to be checked out. So this might drag on a little bit. And of course, there's no deadline to when the select committee has to report its findings, its recommendations, so they can drag it out as long as they like. And that was, of course, one of the initial concerns from Republicans. They did not want this to carry into 2022, into the midterm election year, and have it become a campaign issue. But when the Senate blocked the independent commission, they lost their right to make that that kind of determination. So Pelosi has left it open-ended, and Thompson said, I'm not putting a timeline on it. We'll let the facts take us where they go, and we'll release our report when we're done. But there's no indication when that might be.
We're talking with Mike Lillis. He's on Capitol Hill. And very briefly, the other headline today, Representative Liz Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming, selected by Speaker Pelosi.
Right. And, you know, that wasn't a surprise. Cheney, of course, has been the most prominent, the most vocal, you know, the most biting critic of President Trump on the Republican side of the aisle since January 6th. She voted to impeach him. She voted for the independent commission. She was, of course, removed from her leadership post for being so vocal and not towing the party line and defending Trump on that day. And Pelosi had signaled a couple of days ago that she might appoint a Republican. So all things considered, everybody was guessing that Cheney would be the one. You know, she's really gone out on a limb here, and there's a lot of people in Wyoming who are just dying to primary her. I think all of that's going to, at this point, it didn't really matter that she was going to join the Select Committee. She's so far out on a limb that that she's really a target for many Trump supporters, any conservative base that the Republicans have, and Wyoming is one of the redder states out there. So I feel like she probably felt like she had nothing to lose, and she clearly feels very strongly about this. You know, she's from a political dynasty. There are traditions there that she's trying to uphold, and she thinks that, that what happened on January 6th is a real travesty, a real threat to democracy, and she thinks anybody defending Trump in the aftermath is violating that oath, and she doesn't want to be among them, even if that makes her a pariah within the party. So what is going to be fascinating is, and this is a dynamic we really haven't ever seen up here, not in my experience anyway, is you know, you can imagine some conservative Trump supporters on this Select Committee, and everybody's going to be watching. It's going to be on TV, and if you know Benny Thompson is going at it with Jim Jordan or something like that, that's kind of dog bites man type of story. You expect Democrats and Republicans to go after each other, but in this case, if you've got somebody like Jim Jordan going after Liz Cheney, that makes it a totally different dynamic there. And it, of course, this plays to Pelosi's advantage, to the Democrats' advantage, because the Select Committee is already bipartisan, even if McCarthy doesn't appoint anybody at all. So and it's a one-sided bipartisan sentiment. Their position, of course, is that Trump was at fault on January 6th, and there should be some kind of repercussion and some kind of recommendation for how to prevent this from happening.
The story tonight at thehill.com. Mike Lillis on Capitol Hill this Thursday. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve. Anytime.
And welcome back to Washington Today for this Thursday, the 1st of July. I'm Steve Scully with producer Shannon Rice, and in London, Prince William and Prince Harry on hand to unveil a statue of their mother, Princess Diana, on what would have been her 60th birthday. And in New York, the mayor announcing that singers Bruce Springsteen, Paul Simon, and Jennifer Hudson, the three will headline a concert in Central Park August the 21st, the goal to celebrate New York City's comeback from COVID. Well, the latest coronavirus variant is adding a new urgency in the drive to get more shots in the arms as well as to slow its spread. The vaccines most used in Western countries still appear to offer strong protection against the highly contagious Delta variant that was first identified in India, now spreading to more than 90 other countries. However, the World Health Organization warning this week that the trifecta of easier-to-spread strains, populations not fully immunized, and a drop in the mask use collectively will delay the end to this pandemic. At today's virtual White House briefing, this update from the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky.
Yesterday, CDC reported 14,875 new cases of COVID-19. Our seven-day average is about 12,600 cases per day. And while this is a 95% decrease lower from our peak in early January, it does also reflect a 10% increase in the seven-day average from last week. The seven-day average of hospital admissions is about 1,822 per day, a decrease of about 1% from the prior seven-day period. And the seven-day average of daily deaths was about 257. Looking across the country, we have made incredible progress towards ending the pandemic. we continue to see overall low numbers of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. However, looking state by state and county by county, it is clear that communities where people remain unvaccinated are communities that remain vulnerable. This is all true as we monitor the continued spread of the hypertransmissible Delta variant. The Delta variant is predicted to be the second most prevalent variant in the United States, and I expect that in the coming weeks, it will eclipse the Alpha variant. An estimated 25% of all reported SARS-CoV-2 sequences nationwide are the Delta variant. And in some regions of the country, nearly one in two sequences is the Delta variant. There are communities that are vulnerable and where we are now seeing surges in cases and indeed also hospitalizations due to what could be the spread of the Delta variant and low vaccination rates in these communities. Currently, approximately 1,000 counties in the United States have vaccination coverage of less than 30%. These communities, primarily in the Southeast and Midwest, are our most vulnerable. In some of these areas, we are already seeing increasing rates of disease. As the Delta variant continues to spread across the country, we expect to see increased transmissions in these communities unless we can vaccinate more people now. As you will hear from Dr. Fauci shortly, our authorized vaccines provide protection against the circulating variants in this country, including Delta. Vaccination is how we protect these individuals, families, and communities and prevent severe disease, hospitalizations, and deaths from COVID-19. Preliminary data from a collection of states over the last 6 months suggest 99.5% of deaths from COVID-19 in these states have occurred in unvaccinated people. Any suffering or death from COVID-19 is tragic.
That from Dr. Walensky. She is the CDC director, and according to a study by the Associated Press, nearly all COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. now are among the unvaccinated. The CDC saying those deaths were entirely preventable. There's also new public health questions, including the ongoing debate over mask wearing. Should it be resumed? Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Can you tell us more about whether or not Americans may be having to go back to wearing masks in light of the Delta variant? We saw Los Angeles County and the WHO both recommending that even vaccinated people should wear masks. Where does that stand? Should people be preparing themselves to possibly going back to wearing masks if they're vaccinated?
Dr. Fauci?
Well, as I was alluding to in my comments, you have a broad recommendation for the country as a whole, which is the CDC recommendation that if you are vaccinated, you have a high degree of protection, so you need not wear a mask either indoor or outdoor. But also, as is said, and as the CDC has recommended, is that there's a degree of flexibility. People at the local level, depending upon the on-ground situation, will make recommendations or not according to the local situation. But the broad recommendation that the CDC makes based on the high degree of effectiveness of the vaccine remains unchanged.
Those questions to Dr. Anthony Fauci during a White House virtual briefing. And joining us on the phone is infectious disease expert Dr. Michael Sag. He is with the University of Alabama at Birmingham. A year ago, he battled and survived COVID-19. And Dr. Sag, I want to begin with this Delta variant. Why is it so dangerous?
Well, Steve, the biggest issue with the Delta variant is that it's very, very contagious. It's very easy to pick up. And the danger is for the people in our country who have not been vaccinated, they are like kindling wood for a wildfire. And this variant, to put it in perspective, dealing with the original SARS virus we had a year and a half ago, the one that I caught back in March, that one, you'd have to be in a room with someone for, say, 8 to 10 minutes to pick it up if you were indoors. This Delta variant, you're in the room for about a minute and you'll pick it up. So it's that much more infectious. And for people who are vulnerable, meaning unvaccinated, this virus can spread like wildfire, and that's why there's so much concern about it.
If you have been vaccinated, what are the risk factors?
Well, for someone who has otherwise no underlying health condition, you're pretty well protected, especially if you've gotten the Pfizer and Moderna full vaccination, that is both shots. The J&J also protects maybe a little bit less. And what I'm talking about in terms of protection is against symptomatic infections. So some of us might pick it up, but be asymptomatic. For people who do get sick with the Delta variant and they've been vaccinated, the illness will typically be milder and of shorter duration compared to someone who's not been vaccinated. Steve, the one population that we're concerned about, though, who have been vaccinated and might get exposed to Delta variant are people who are solid organ transplant recipients, heart, kidney, lung, that type of thing. And their immune systems are, by definition, impaired because they have to take medication to keep their immune system from attacking the transplant organ. Those folks, and as well as people on immune suppressive agents for rheumatoid disease or psoriasis, inflammatory bowel disease, my advice to those folks is to be vigilant about symptoms. If you sense that you are getting sick, call your doctor right away and get tested. And if you test positive, gain access to monoclonal antibody. That'll shorten the course and minimize duration.
And Dr. Saig, these new concerns coming at the start of the July 4th holiday weekend, a lot of Americans getting ready to hit the road, many who could not travel a year ago. Where does this put the mask debate and the issue of social distancing?
Yeah, if I'm unvaccinated and I'm going out, I'm wearing a mask. And I hope that others who are unvaccinated are wearing a mask too. Unfortunately, what I'm observing where I live in Alabama, but I think it's happening throughout the country, a lot of people are behaving, most of us, in fact, as if this epidemic is over, and it's not. If you're unvaccinated and you get exposed to the Delta variant, there's a pretty good chance you're going to get infected with it and a pretty good chance you'll get sick. The one thing I didn't say earlier is the other concerning part about Delta is that it causes more disease, especially in young people. So a lot of young folks have said, I'm not going to worry about this. I'm young. COVID doesn't really affect me very much. Well, the Delta variant is a different beast. And so you really want to be careful. My advice to everyone, of course, is just if you haven't been vaccinated, rethink and go out and get vaccinated. It will protect you as well as family members around you, especially if they're not vaccinated, against picking up this Delta variant.
And one final point, because you are in Alabama, one of the states where the vaccination rate is well below 50%. Why?
It's a loaded question. I think there's a myriad of different reasons, but just to make it succinct, there are some people who are just still hesitant. They want to see some other people go first. Some folks who are a little confused about messaging, and they need a little bit more reliable information. Some people are just frankly not all that trusting of the information they have received or authorities telling them. And then there's another group of people who, for whatever reason, be it political persuasion or perhaps because they think this is some sort of conspiracy and that there's something evil about getting vaccinated, those are some of the reasons that I'm hearing. But for the first couple of groups, hesitant, need more information, maybe need to hear it from other trusted voices, those are the group of people who I'd like to see get vaccinated in the next couple of weeks. I think they're likely to. And for the other group, just I'd encourage them to rethink their positioning and have a little bit of an open mind. This vaccine is a rescue. This is our exit strategy getting out of this epidemic. I think if we all participated, we all get there faster.
One of the experts we turn to here at C-SPAN, Dr. Michael Saig. He's joining us from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be with you.
On Wall Street, some big gains for the big board. The Dow rose 131 points. The NASDAQ up 18.5. The S&P rose 22. In New York, prosecutors charging the Trump Organization with a, quote, 15-year scheme to defraud the government and its chief financial officer with grand larceny and tax fraud. That happened inside a courtroom today, describing what they said was a wide-ranging effort to hide income from tax authorities. In the papers, prosecutors alleged that Alan Weisselberg, former President Donald Trump's longtime chief financial officer, or CFO, had avoided more than $900,000 in taxes by concealing the value of benefits that he received from Trump's company. Those benefits including a free apartment, a free Mercedes-Benz, new furniture, and tuition payments for his relatives. In internal records, the Trump Organization treated these benefits as part of Weisselberg's compensation, according to prosecutors, but did not report them to taxing authorities, allowing him and the company to avoid taxes. In a statement released late today, the former president saying, quote, "The political witch hunt by the radical left Democrats and New York now taking over the assignment, it continues. It is dividing our country like never before." We will talk to one of the Washington Post reporters who's been covering this story. But first, with reaction to these indictments, Susan Necklace, one of the attorneys for the Trump Organization.
I think all Americans should be concerned about what they see in this case today. This case is truly unprecedented. The Attorney General's office and the District Attorney's office brought a joint prosecution here because they dislike Donald Trump politically. They subpoenaed millions of documents from him personally and pressured witnesses that so that those witnesses, trying to make those witnesses tell them things that Donald Trump, that they wanted to hear, that Donald Trump had done things criminally, which they did not, the witnesses did not do because they could not do. Although Carrie Dunn in court said this was not a political prosecution, I think you can all see what has happened in the press, what you've seen over the last year, and the comments that Attorney General Letitia James has repeatedly made. She campaigned on a promise that she would get Donald Trump. She repeatedly said she would use all areas of the law to get Donald Trump, and this is a joint prosecution. While she was Attorney General and while President Trump was in office, she sued him 70 times using New York taxpayer money. She called him an illegitimate president repeatedly. So this is the person who now with the DA's office have teamed up together to bring this unprecedented prosecution.
For the last several years, David Fahrenthold of The Washington Post has been looking closely into the financial workings of the Trump Organization. He is joining us from New York. Let me begin with today's criminal indictments. Your reaction, what stands out?
Well, it seems like prosecutors have found a pretty well-documented, long-running scheme by the Trump Organization to avoid paying taxes on some of its executives' income. Basically, they even kept a little ledger in which they wrote down what the real compensation was and then told the IRS that the number was actually something less, so they saved money. That part seems to be very well-documented, and it seems like they have a strong case. What's missing here, and what may just be coming down the road, is evidence about a lot of the other bigger issues that the DA and the Attorney General had talked about in the past. What's also missing is any sense, really, that Donald Trump was involved in guiding this or creating this system. It's really concentrated to one CFO and to other folks beyond Trump in the organization.
So where does this put Alan Weisselberg, who is the Trump Organization's chief financial officer?
Well, he is certainly – he's facing 15 counts or I think 14 counts of criminal counts, including grand larceny, tax fraud, and falsifying business records. Those are all serious crimes. None of them carry a mandatory prison sentence, and it's possible that even if he was convicted, he might not see prison time. That said, this man is 73. He's worked for Trump his whole life. And now, you know, today, because of Trump, he got marched into a courtroom and is facing some significant personal legal trouble. I'm sure it was not the bust that Trump's attorneys had made it out to be, where Weisselberg might only owe a few thousand dollars and could, you know, easily pay it off and leave. It's serious, but it's serious for Weisselberg at this point and not yet for Donald Trump.
But this follows years of investigations going now after the CFO of the Trump Organization, the president not facing any charges, telling Sean Hannity on Fox News last night it's all nonsense, saying it's the New York radical left prosecutors coming after me. So politically, where does this put the former president?
I mean, I think he will continue to claim that it is a witch hunt, that they're out to get him. But if anybody's going to read the documents, that argument got a lot harder to make once we saw the indictments. You know, this is not the crime of the century, but it is a well-documented, long-running, and significant amount of money, if you believe prosecutors. They think that Weisselberg alone evaded at least $900,000 worth of taxes. So, you know, it's not starting an insurrection, but it's a significant allegation. I think for Trump, the question is what comes next? Is this the end? Do they have more evidence, or are they going to flip Alan Weisselberg, or would this possibly be the extent of his legal troubles? If that's the case, probably Trump will breathe a sigh of relief that it's not worse.
Well, let me conclude on that point, because as mentioned earlier, you have spent years poring over the documents, the financial records of the Trump Organization. What questions remain tonight for you personally as a reporter for The Washington Post?
Well, my main question is, what's become of the more serious allegations that the investigators have mentioned in earlier documents, where they said they were interested in Trump's role in the payoffs to Stormy Daniels in the 2016 presidential election, interested in the Trump Organization's alleged efforts to wrongfully value their properties in order to save on their taxes, to fool their lenders. There's even a mention of $102 million forgiven debt that the Trump Organization was supposed to pay taxes on. All those things are mentioned as subjects of inquiry, and none of them appear in this document. Now, the AG and the DA have said the case goes on, the investigation goes on, so maybe we'll get some answers to those down the line. But the most serious issues we've been told this investigation is about really aren't addressed in this indictment.
David Fahrenthold in New York covering today's grand jury indictment of the Trump Organization. His work available at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And finally, we want to note the passing of Albert Eisley, a founding editor of the Hill newspaper. He had a long and often storied career here in our nation's capital. He was 85 years old, also a frequent guest on the C-SPAN networks. The Hill's editor-in-chief, Bob Cusack, saying that Al Eisley was an institution at the Hill. He began his career as a writer and journalist, then served as Vice President Walter Mondale's press secretary, and returned to his passion for journalism. Back in 2004, a panel discussion on C-SPAN's coverage of politics in Congress, he made these remarks.
I don't know why I was chosen for this task of moderating this distinguished panel, but believe me, this is an all-star cast, and I'm honored to do it. Maybe it had something to do with the fact that I interviewed Brian Lamb on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of C-SPAN, and I guess I wrote a good article about him. Reference was made to my journalism career, which started way back in earlier in 1960s when I worked in papers in Minnesota. But when the St. Paul Pioneer Press and Dispatch assigned me to Washington as a Washington correspondent, one of my editors at the paper said, "By leaving here and going to Washington, you will raise the intellectual level of both communities." you have to think about that for a little bit. The Hill newspaper I helped start 10 years ago in September of 1994. I was pleased to pick up the New York Times today and read a story about the president's tailor, Georges de Paris, and about the bulge in the president's back of his coat, which has got all of the conspiracy theory freaks really revved up. I wrote a story several weeks ago. I went to see Georges de Paris and wrote, he said the president wears the same size you do, 44 long coat, so put on this coat and cross your arms like this and you'll see it causes a bulge in your back. So I had a photographer with me and we took a picture and ran it in the paper, and of course that really got people riled up. Then after it ran, a friend of mine in the Secret Service called and said, you know, it's really not what it is he was wearing a bulletproof vest and it's the bulge in the back is caused by that. They didn't want be known that it was. But anyway, this is the story about that story. So we are read in New York as well as Washington. The Hill is a nonpartisan, non-ideological newspaper. I describe us as equal opportunity bashers. We beat up on Democrats and Republicans alike, independents too. But people ask me how, since you work for Walter Mondale, how can you be objective and nonpartisan about Republicans? And I say, well, I tell them a story about Franklin Roosevelt when he went to Pittsburgh and gave a very inflammatory speech and said something very controversial. And the next morning, all the reporters came to his press secretary, Steve Early, and said, Steve, what does the president have to say about that speech he gave in Pittsburgh? So he went to see the president. He said, Mr. President, what do I tell the reporters about what you said in Pittsburgh? And FDR said, Steve, tell them I've never been to Pittsburgh. So I tell people I never worked for Mondale. It's not true.
That from Al Eisley back in November of 2004, the founding editor of the Hill newspaper. He died. Al Eisley was 85 years old. A reminder, all of our coverage, it's available online anytime at cspan.org. And this program, it's also available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. I'm Steve Scully in Washington, hoping you enjoy the rest of your Thursday.